podcast that you're about to hear comes from a program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. These sessions have been facilitated by Christian Teusner from the Emu Tree in partnership with the Wakery RSL sub-branch. To explore further podcasts, visit thewaywewere.podbean.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening. I'm here this morning with Reginald James Enoch. Thank you, Reg, for agreeing to speak with me this morning. Just to clarify, can you please state your full name and your date of birth, please?
Reginald James Enoch, 25th of the 4th, 1929.
Where were you born? Where did you grow up, Reg?
I was born at Greenock, up in the Borough of Ossa. And I don't know much about Greenock because just after I was born, we moved over to Tarcoola. My dad was moved over there to work on the railways. He did have his own transport business in, or just the one truck at Greenock. And he used to cart gear for Seconda Lauki's dad. He's the big mill man.
What was your father's name, Reg?
Frederick John Enoch Singh. Now, my dad was born in South Africa, in Johannesburg.
And when did he come out to Australia?
Moved into Yadunda. And my grandfather was given a block of land up there, and the wreck of his house is still up there, and we went up there, and he's buried there, and we went up for some time, quite a few dependents. We went up there and put a headstone and whatnot that for, because before there was, you know, nothing there, just
lovely.
So we put a headstone up there.
What about your mother? Where did your mother come from?
Yeah, that's a good question. As far as I know, she was born in Loyola. As I say, we moved to Tarcoola, and that's where I started school. Now,
what do you remember of your school days?
I hated school. I know I can remember the first day I went to school, my teacher, because the school itself was nearly a mile away from the township of Tarcoola itself. You'd look out and you could see it, but, and he used to put me on his shoulders and carry me to school. But the first day I was there, I can still remember this, I started whistling, and he got me up and he said, if you whistle again, he said, I'm going to take your clothes off and put you in a cage and you can whistle all day. Now, I remember that quite clearly. But the rest of my school days, as I say, I could have done without school because I didn't like it.
You didn't like it. It wasn't for you.
But
so what year was it when you started school?
Approximately. Oh, please.
1934, 35?
Yeah, it would have been around about 35. Yeah. And then after a while, my dad got a transfer to a big town on the east-west railway line called Xanthus, Zanthus, which comprised of six houses and a school. And I always said they could have left the school out. It was a stop-off point for the train, where, of course, in those days it was still steam, and there was a big coal tender where they used to refill their tenders. we had to, there was no shop. We had to wait every Saturday for what they call the tea and sugar. It had a grocery carriage on it and a butcher's van on it, and that's where you got your weekly gear. You could always remember just before the train got to Xanthus, the stewards used to fill all the fresh fruit bowls up, and when it left there was no fresh food left because we used to raid it. They knew that, and that's why they filled it all up. And then about five of us lads, we got to know the engineers and all that, and they used to take us out 4 or 5 miles on the engine and train, and then they'd slow down a bit and we'd hop off and walk all the way back home again, which was really great.
What age were you at this point?
I must have been, about 7 or 8, I think. Yeah.
So what would you do to entertain yourself?
Well, we'd go out in the bush and just mess around. And there was two families. One, the Cook brothers, they had a sheep station, and the Dimer brothers, they had a cattle station. And whenever they were coming in, we'd know, and we'd go over, and there was these two gum trees. They were white, and we called them the ghost gums. And we'd meet the Cook brothers or the Dimer brothers, and we'd come in to Xanthus with them, help them, you know, load the either sheep or cattle. Then they'd take us back up, drop us off at the Twin Ghost, and we'd walk back home again. That was about 7 miles. So, but that was, you know, we had fun.
Good healthy lifestyle.
Yeah. And there was the native reserve, which Mr. and Mrs. Carlisle and their daughter Dorothy, who was a native, reserve. A lot of times we used to go out with the Aborigines and help them, hunt down goats or snakes and goannas, and whatever we caught they'd take back. But that part there was really enjoyable. I was sorry actually when we moved over here to Adelaide in, I think it was 1940, because that was when my grandmother passed away and Dad moved, or the whole family moved over to stay with grandfather. I was a bit disappointed to leave over there, isolated as it was. We saw one cow while we were there, and that was about it. Well, there was only about 12 children there, and most of the boys would go out.
Did everybody get along okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was...
Never any problems?
Only with one of the teachers. We had a bit of a problem. Well, my eldest brother did, because I can still remember this. He don't ask me his name now, it's too long ago. But he had the big, the long cane, and John had to go up and get the cane. But instead of hitting him across the hand, he hit him across the wrist. And when we got home, John showed him the bruise across here. First thing Dad did was up to see the teacher and told him what would happen if anything like that happened again. And we got a bit of a revenge with him, because we used to, these tins, we'd put a hole in the end and we'd get bits of carbine and you'd spit on it and you'd put the lid on and it would create a gas. And we, the teacher's house was up a bit and all us boys got underneath the house, lit the bottom of these tins, and it was like about 6 or 7 cannons going off. And next minute we were out in the bush, so the teacher never knew for sure who did it, so we got away with it.
Where did you move to, and what are your first memories of Adelaide?
Oh, that's too far away to remember that. I know we moved into 16 Union Street, Stepney, which is my grandfather's place. Or it was. It's disappeared now, of course. It's
gone, is it?
Yeah.
And where did you go to school in Adelaide?
Norwood School. And as I say, I was dissatisfied with school, so I said to Mum, I'm not going to school anymore. But she got into the education department and they said, well, you can go to Sturt School in town, which was worse off. But while I was at Sturt School, Street School, there was an advertising place or printing place, Thornquist Press, and they were looking for somebody to work there. So that's where I finished up. I went over and seen them and they said, all right, you get permission, you can start. So
what age were you when you started working?
Oh, must have been about 15, 16.
And what were you doing there with Thornquist Press? What were your duties?
Oh, it was just a matter of delivering, printing. You'd go around to the different companies who were getting their printing work done, and they had this pushbot with a big a box in front of it. There was like the two wheels, then the one wheel that you pedalled, and that was mostly that. The other part was the lead knot where where you got the joints in the papers. You had to sort of keep that up to scratch. But then it was not long after that. There was a vacancy over at SA Hardwoods on Paynham Road. That's not there now anymore either. So, which was called the Tailor Out. You were on the other end of the saw and you was, whatever was cut, you'd tailor it, put it into different. And after a while, they got this special order and they said, would you like to get on the saw and do it? So I thought, oh, that's a bit of an up. And what you do there is you've got one hand on the bit that you're cutting and you've got a stick this end and you'd be pushing backwards and forwards onto the blade. And on the other end of the saw, there was this like a knife which separated the pieces that you're cutting. And anyway, I was going pretty fast to get it done, but one time this hand or the bit I was cutting stayed there and my hand didn't, and it went across the saw, and you can just see the little bit there where cut that bit off there.
Ooh. Wow, you're lucky to still have your finger.
I didn't even know it happened. And all I heard was a flip. And then they tried a bit of, I don't think it's there now. Yeah, little bits there. They tried to put on there and it didn't work.
or skin graft.
And anyway, they rushed me into the Adelaide Hospital and just sort of bandaged it up. And I was off for about 3 weeks, and I thought, I went into Torrens Depot, and I thought, I'll join up the military service, you know, something to do. And I signed on for that on the second floor, and I came down to the first floor and saw the recruiting office for the regular army. So I thought, why not? So I signed on to the regular army.
Do you remember what the date was?
3rd of September 1948.
You were 19 years of age?
Yeah. And
that's quite a change of direction, isn't it?
Yeah. And I went home, said to Mum and Dad, I've joined the army.
And what was their reaction?
Oh, they didn't worry. Yeah, when I say they didn't worry, they didn't mind. There was nothing at that stage, you know, there was nothing violent going on. And I went to Greta first, sorry.
Okay.
That's where we did the recruit training, at Greta, just out from Newcastle.
And what do you remember about your training?
Oh,
Was it tough?
Some of it was, yeah, some of it was. But after you've done it, a few times, you got used to it. But the only thing I remember, we had to go to Newcastle to do our new bronze medallion. It was, at that time, was part of the training. And on the way back, we stopped at this station. I didn't know the name then, and I don't know the name now. But as we were going over to get back onto the train, three of the mates, there was these big wire cages on the platform. Three of the mates got me and shoved me in one. And the only trouble was, the opening was that end, and the other end I couldn't get out. And next minute, the old whistle of the train went and it started moving off. And it just luck happened that one of the porters had seen what had happened. So, you know, before the train got too fast, he came rushing over and opened the back door and got me by the legs and grabbed me out. And I started running to the train. And one of the mates threw a cup at me and I caught it and threw it back, but he didn't catch it. But unbeknown to me, a certain corporal, and his name I'll remember, is Corporal Tarr. Next minute, after I'd got on the train, he came up, he said, I've been looking for you, and I was put on a charge. And when we got back to Greta, I fronted up the OC, and it cost me a quid or a pound. And because we were on pounds, shillings and pence then, it cost me a pound and 7 days CB. That stage we were only getting £2.07 and six a fortnight. So I did my CB and all that. And the good thing about that was you had a better breakfast, better dinner and better meal, because you got, if you was in the officer's mess, you got the same meal as them. It was only a couple of weeks after that. I only just finished my CB and we were all lined up to go and get our lunch. And as we went in, there was a seat on the first table, and who should be orderly NCO was Corporal Tarr. So he said to me, you sit there. And I said, well, we always sit together. He said, well, I'm telling you to sit there. I said, all right. So I sat down there. As he went up the aisle, I grabbed my gear and followed him up and sat with the mates. But unfortunately, when he went out, he saw the vacant seat. So he came looking for me and he said, I thought I told you to sit on that front table. I said, yeah, but I told you we sit with the mates. Another quid in 7 days. So the mates started calling me Rocky Ned the Outlaw. Then after a while they said, well, look, we can't keep calling you that. So from then on, and even still now, the mates see me, anybody, I'm Rocky. And that was part of my experience with the training. And then when I finished training, we came back to 2 Battalion, which I'd left, and they'd formed, well, they were forming 4 Battalion, and I was amongst some of them that went up to originally start up 4 Battalion.
I love that story, sorry. Just, I love that story, Rocky Ned the Outlaw.
Rocky Ned the Outlaw.
Yeah, that's terrific. Like, that is such a special little piece of you, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, of who you are.
And, yeah.
You know, and how people know you and remember you. Yeah. That's a terrific story.
Oh, yeah. As I say now, there's not too many of the mates in the army you know me first name. It's always been Rocky, so that's... Then they needed reinforcements to go to 3 Battalion with the occupation forces in Japan.
How did you feel at that point when you knew that you were heading off to Japan?
Oh, it was a bit of excitement, you know. You're going to Japan, somewhere you've never been, and everything's all right. You're just doing normal duties as you sort of were back here in Australia. Your normal training and guard duties and all that sort of business. And it was something different. And but then North Korea invaded South Korea.
Do you remember that day?
Oh, yeah. I do now. But... we couldn't go over straight away because we weren't, or 3 Battalion weren't up to full strength. And that's when they formed this K-Force, which was K-Force, yeah. They advertised ex-servicemen who had, you know, overseas duty to sign on for 12 months. And once the 12 months was up, they could either stay in or get out, but they'd get the same conditions that, you know, regular army fellas did. And that's how 3 Battalion got up to strength. The 3 Battalion didn't go to Korea until, was it September 1950?
You were 21 years of age at that point.
Yeah, getting on to 21, yeah.
2020.
In April, yeah. And I was trying to think of the name. We went by boat, and I'm trying to think of the... Anyway, we landed at Busan, which is now Busan. I don't know why they changed the P to a B. A B. Well, when we first landed, there was a... all black band, American band, and they were playing "If We Knew You Were Coming, We'd Have Baked a Cake." I remember that. Yeah, and
it's great you remember the song. "If I Knew You Were Coming,
We'd Have Baked a Cake." And then, of course, we embarked on transport trucks and open semi-trailers on that, up to a place called Taegu, which was the our jumping off place. That's where we actually started, I suppose, being involved in the Korean War. It was only a few days that we started seeing, you know, action.
That must have been quite frightening, but still, you know, quite exciting that, you know, all this
It was, as I say, it was frightening for a while, but you, like everything else, that you get used to it. But the only downside to all this, on the 3rd of October, it's not long after we arrived there, Colonel Green, who was our CO, he was killed. We were under attack and with like the infantry and artillery, and the officers from headquarters told him to. They set up his tent and they sent up Major Ferguson, who was 2IC. They set up his tent under a tree, but Colonel Green's tent was sort of out in the open, and he said, well, why is my tent out in the open? And they said, well, if an artillery shell hits the tree, it'll fall on Major Ferguson's tree. Oh, fair enough sort of business. But unfortunately, there was a stray shell that hit near Colonel Green's tent, and a bit of shrapnel went through it and hit him, and they raced him off to one of the big MASH hospitals. But unfortunately, his wound was too serious. They couldn't save him, and he passed away. And then, ironically, Major Ferguson then became Colonel Ferguson. He took over the battalion and was promoted to Colonel. Yeah. Well, Colonel Green was, he was ex-service too. He'd had service during World War II, so, and he had already had a DSO and Distinguished Service Order. And he was very popular with the troops of the battalion. It was just something unfortunate that it happened like it did. But as I say, then we sort of just kept on going, and saw action here and there, and a lot of the times we had to cover up for the Americans. You know, they were withdrawing, so we'd have to fill in for them to cover their withdrawals. And
how did you get on with the Americans?
Oh, they were too gung-ho. No, I don't know. We didn't associate too much with them. We more or less associated more with the New Zealanders and the Canadians and British and the Turkish troops. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd sort of keep away from the Yanks as much as we could, but if you wanted something, you'd just go over there and say, look, how about this, you know? No worries, you know, you could have it. But to be really comrades with them, they, no.
How would you spend your downtime? What would you do?
Well, we didn't have too much brown time, because we'd sort of be in one lot of action, and you'd move over for somewhere else. The longest place we'd ever been was called Yui Jongbu, which is where we spent 50-51 Christmas on there. We still sort of did patrols and all that, but we, you know, didn't have, not in actions, we were sort of resting. And we used to have beer rations and cigarette rations, but the weather over there, I don't know if you know, but it was down to 30 degrees below freezing, and every now and again you used to hear a bit of a pop, pop, beer bottles exploding. And the NAFI, the British canteen, they reckon they lost 2,000 bottles in one night because of it. After a while, the boys sort of woke up to it and tried to keep their bottles as hot as or as warm as they could. But
and how did they do that?
Oh, in a month, just put them into their clothing. But the only trouble is, see, when we first went over there, we had no winter uniforms. We had the same uniforms we had in Japan, which wasn't suitable for something 30 below, you know.
I've heard that from many people, actually, yeah.
Yeah, we just had to put up with what, until the Yanks, which was one good thing, they came good and supplied us with their winter uniform.
So how was your health during all this?
Personally, I was all right, but a lot of the boys did go down with frostbite and or pneumonia and stuff like that, because we first only had a blanket and a ground sheet. That was all the cover we had. And if it rained or snow, what do you do? I can remember the first night it did snow, I was due to go on picket, and I heard this patter, 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 and I thought, oh, it's raining. But when I went to get out of the weapon pit, I put my arms on the side, and they sort of went down like that, and there was about that much snow on the edges of the... As I say, it got that cold even, you know, the rivers would freeze up. You could drive trucks, tanks, anything over them, they were, you know, they froze solid. You just,
It's hard to imagine when you live in Australia, those conditions, isn't
it? This is it, you know, the people back here, they treated us like lepers when we got back. Even the RSL didn't want much to do with us when we first got back, but fortunately things came good. But the people, you know, the people back home here, as you say, they didn't realise exactly what was going on in Korea. Not only for us, everybody that was there. Fortunately, I suppose, it eventually came to a bit of an end, the biggest thing I remember, others have probably told you, was the Battle of Cap Yong. I was involved in that, but just prior to it, we were in reserve, and that's one time we did have a bit of a break, but there was the 60th Rock Regiment, which was Republic of Korean Division, and that was supposed to have been their crack unit. And Anzac Day was coming up, so with, you know, all those troops standing by if anything happened, we started making preparations to celebrate Anzac Day, and we were going to invite some of the Kiwis over, and we had the Turkish brigade near us. We're going to get some of them to come over, and everything was going all right for a while. And then word came down that there was a division of Chinese heading down south with the intent of attempting to capture Seoul, which would have been a big victory for them. So they sent the South Korean division up to meet them and sort of stop them. But unfortunately, when the South Koreans met the Chinese, they just turned around and started heading back. As I say, they were panicking. A lot of them were throwing their weapons and gear away so they had... walk quicker, they got past us, they had a large number of refugees behind them, and behind them were the Chinese.
So they were deserting?
sort of deserted, yeah, but I suppose, you know, they might have said, well, we were trying to get back to reinforce Seoul again, but they were definitely, most of them were deserting because none of the NCOs or officers could appear to be able to control them. And anyway, just prior to this, each company commander had to go forward and reconnoitre their position where they'd have to go if the time came that we had to go forward. And anyway, we eventually had to go forward and take up the different positions. And at that stage, I was with A Company, which was Major O'Dowd, Benny O'Dowd. He was the CEO of A Company. And our positions, looking north, our A Company and D Company were on the right side of the road, and B and C were on the left, and headquarters was overlooking the road. And fortunately for us, when the rocks went up, New Zealand sent batteries of artillery to support them, and when they got to 3 Battalion, they just left the rocks and set up to support us. But as they said, they couldn't support us during the night because the fighting actually started on the night of the 23rd. They said they couldn't support us because they couldn't, you know, range their guns in. So we had to wait for in the morning. And when the morning came, it was just like a swarm of bees. The Kiwis said afterwards, during the Battle of Cap Yong, they'd fired off 10,000 rounds. And
that's incredible, isn't it? That's incredible.
Yeah. They just without them, we would have been gone. You know, we had to have something like that. And anyway, during the course of the battle, B Company had to withdraw from their position because there was a possibility of being overrun, and our flank was then open to B Company's position. And not only were we getting fire from the front, we were getting it from the side, from the Chinese on B Company's position. And Major O'Dowd had taken over as battalion commander because Colonel Ferguson had moved headquarters about 5 kilometres to the rear. And Major O'Dowd got in touch with him. He said, well, what do we do now? And he said, Colonel Ferguson said, well, you're the senior officer, you're in charge. So he told B Company commander to retake his former position. And by the time they got back to try and take it, there was too many Chinese there and they just couldn't do it. So they had to withdraw back to you know, higher ground. We never used the word retreat. It was always withdraw because we weren't retreating. And I'm trying to... Lieutenant General MacArthur got sacked prior to this. Truman recalled him to Washington because it was MacArthur's fault that China came into the war. Because MacArthur said he was going to push North Korean troops across the border into Manchuria. China said, no, you're not, and they came into it. So, as I say, President Truman called him back to Washington and virtually sacked him. And I can't think of the Lieutenant General that took over, but well, it was sort of a request and an order that we hold on for as long as we could so that they could form a defensive line around Seoul. Well, we held on from the night of the 23rd until the evening of the 24th. And as Major Dowd said, well, we can't sort of hold on anymore because we'd no ammunition. He's just sort of joking. He said we could fight them with the bayonets, but there's too many of them. So we had to withdraw. And he got in touch with all the company commanders and said, you know, do a tactical withdrawal.
During this time, like you said, from the night of the 23rd until the evening of the 24th?
Yeah.
This was ongoing. Did you have any moment of reprieve or rest?
No.
Or was it just constant?
Nothing to eat, nothing to drink. It was just continual fighting. Because, you know, they'd put in an attack and we'd push it back and they'd have fresh troops waiting and they'd come in, and it kept on going like that. And they used to use bugles and whistles and all that, and that was the officers, you know, getting their troops together, whether ready to advance. But once they stopped, you know, their bugles and all that, we knew they were coming in, and you were sort of waiting for them. Mm-hmm. But, well, when you think of it, there was, 10,000 of them and just 464 of us. But we sort of, they had the advantage of numbers, but we had the advantage of the high ground. And, you know, it's much harder attacking high ground regardless of what numbers you've got.
Mm.
After the Chinese attacked us, they then had a go at the Canadians, Princess Pat Canadian Light Infantry, and the same thing happened. The Canadians stopped them, and they sort of thought, well, it doesn't look like we're going to succeed, so the attack was called off. And then from then on, it was just sort of patrolling, and every now and again a bit of incidents happening, but it's pretty quiet.
Was there a moment for you when you realised that they were withdrawing and that, you know, you might just be okay?
Yeah, well, sort of, because of the position with the Yanks, with their defensive positions they'd put on, we realised then that we were going to be okay, because, you know, the Chinese didn't continue their advance, because they knew too that it was beyond them to do what they'd come down to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of relaxed a bit. Then, of course,
I just checked the date. The date of the battle, you said, was
23rd of April, the evening of the 23rd of April, to dusk on the 24th, or all day on the 24th. It comes back a lot. In fact, after a while, I said to the wife, I think we better go in bed, separate bedrooms. Because I was having quite a few bad nightmares, and I thought something might happen and I might harm her. So eventually I I had to go through a psychiatrist, and I'm still going. I suppose when you look back, it was an experience which you didn't expect, but well, you don't regret really, because what you did to sort of the little bit we did to help the South Korean people was more than worthwhile.
Mm, absolutely.
And well, in 2011, we had an invitation from the then president for a return trip to Korea, and everything was paid for: airfares, accommodation, tours, everything. And we weren't the only ones, or the only time it happened. It happened quite often that, you know, Australian, New Zealanders, Canadians, British, they'd put on this big turnout and tours and parades and all that, you know, and they had a big banquet at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of made it, because what the president said, you know, made it worthwhile. Spent 12 months in Vietnam.
So your time in Vietnam then, what year was that?
Pardon?
What year was that? Was it 68?
68, 69, yeah.
And whereabouts were you? Whereabouts were you?
Vung Tau. And we used to operate from Vung Tau to Nui Dat. And then, you know, some of the advanced troops, we'd, you know, take ammunition and barbed wire and all that stuff out to them. But the only thing with that is if we couldn't leave before dark, we had to stay there overnight, because travelling at night, too much of a chance of, you know, ambush, you know. So we'd stay there overnight.
And that was it about 15, 20 kilometres out to Nui Dat?
Yeah, around, yeah. As I say, well, I was, you might as well notice there, I had two hooks there. I was a corporal. I was in charge of number two section of trucks.
So how many years in total were you in service?
24 years. I did from 48 to 54, and then from 56 to 74. But they made up for a lot of it, because they give me a two-year posting to Singapore. I was able to take the whole family. But when I was first told I was had the posting, it was as an RP, regimental policeman. But at that time, I was driving Brigadier Jackson, and he said, "You don't want to go up there as a RP, do you, Corporal?" I said, "Not really, sir." And he said, "Oh, leave it with me, I'll fix it for you." And Daphne James, who was his secretary, told me afterwards he was going to get the posting cancelled altogether. I said I would have kicked him in the guts if he had him. And anyway, I went up there, and the CSM met us off the plane, and he said, "How do you feel about being my RP, Corporal?" I said, "Not very impressed, sir, Major." He said, "Oh, well," he said, "it's all yours for the next 3 weeks." He said, "I'm going back to Australia to do a course." That's all right, I did 3 weeks of nothing. And when he came back, he said, "How do you feel now?" I said, "The same as when you left." Oh, well. And anyway, the lad that was driving, well, it was Air Commodore Seagate. He was a New Zealander, and he was the chief of staff over there. And he said, "Look," he said, "I'll swap you if you like." He said, "I want to go to security when I get home." And he hadn't finished saying that, and the armband was off here. And I took over driving Air Commodore Seagate, and I reckon it was one of the best things I ever did.
Wow.
He was great.
How long did you do that?
Oh, practically the 2 years. Except, as I say, for the 3 weeks that CSM was away, from the then on I was 2 years.
2 years. And what year was this?
1952-54.
Any special memories of, you know, while you were driving, or any unusual things that maybe you experienced?
Well, Air Commodore said to me one day, he said, "Look, go around and pick up the wife and take her out. She wants to go to this shop." So when she got in the car, she said to me, she said, "Look, Corporal," she said, "we'll get our throats cut one day coming out here, but it's the best place in Singapore for making sarongs." But otherwise, as I say, the whole 2 years was really present. There was no incident that I would have complained about. In fact, the missus said, "You couldn't get another 2 years, could you?" But I would have had to re-sign on again, because the same thing, I only had 2 months left in 74 to go. But had I been able to get another, you know, 2 year extension, I would have signed on, no worries. But yep. I didn't really think about it. And when I did come home, they before I left Singapore, I didn't realise then that I only had 2 months to go. And they said, "You've got the choice of going to Kapuka or to Singleton." And I thought, well, Kapuka was closer, and I hadn't been there, so packed the family up and drove overnight, and I got there in the morning and reported in, and I said, "Where do we live?" And they said, "Don't ask us, we've got no place for you." I said, "Oh, well," I said, "you can contact me back in Adelaide." I got in the car and was backing out. Hang on. And I said, "Try this place." You should have seen it. I would have had to have a century tank to get to it. It was up on top of a sandhill. No fence, no garden, nothing. So I went back and I said, "You get me something better than that," or I said, I'm leaving. And they eventually got us into a holiday flat. Anyway, as I say, I was only there for about a month, and they called me up and they said, "Oh, you've got to go back to Adelaide for your discharge." I thought, "Oh, Christ, I only just got here and I'm going all the way back again." So I got back to Adelaide and spent a month back here, and then my army career came to an end.
How did you feel?
Oh, a bit disappointed. I'm going to have to go back just a little bit. When I did come back from Korea, I was going to re-engage, and a stupid sergeant said to me, he said, "Well, you know, you got to do, you'll have to do your recruit training again. And I said, oh, hang on. I said, I'm a qualified corporal. I said, I've had overseas service. I've got subjects for sergeant. And you say, I got to do recruit training again. He said, yeah. I said, oh, you know what you can do with the army. And anyway, that's why the 2 year difference. In 1956, I decided, I might as well. So I did sign on. I did 2 weeks at Kapooka as an assistant instructor, and then I went back to 4 Battalion. And if I had woke up to it earlier and got more information, because I did ask a corporal, colonel, I told him what the situation was, and he said, oh no, he said, you should have been re-engaged as if you hadn't got out. Your service should have continued.
56, coming
up. 56, I joined, re-engaged and went through to 74, which was 18 years.
Was there periods during that time where you almost said, oh, this is not for me anymore, I'm going to back, you know, change my path? Or was it 18 years of just, this is
oh, no, I was sort of looking forward to it all. That's why I regretted not getting further information about, you know, the discharge and all that. But, no, I was, well, the army just seemed to be the life that suited what I wanted. And as I say, I did regret not getting more information about the re-engagement. Well, when I did get out, one of my mates who was in the army with me, he was Ray Ford, but like me, he, being Ford, he got the nickname Henry Ford. So, and he was with the government motor garage, and he was just about getting ready to finish up, and he said to me, he said, why don't you go in to see Andy, who was the manager of the government motor garage, about taking my place. So I went in and had a yarn with him, with Andy. And then I went back a couple of days, and he said, how would you feel about driving Jeff Virgo? I said, oh, well, I said, if he'll have me, I said, yeah, I'll take on. And unbeknownst to me, because the door had been open, and who was sitting behind the door was Jeff Virgo. And he said, well, this is what Jeff said. He said, from what I've heard, you've had enough experience. And he said, you've driven Air Commodores, Generals and whatnot. He said, I'd be quite happy to take you on. So for the next about 4 years, I became a driver with the government motor garage. But we used to work, and a lot of the officers, MPs and that, had their office in Victoria Square there, and worked from Parliament House. And you'd have to, like, pick them up from home and bring them to work and take them back. And
that must have been an interesting period for you.
Yeah, it was, until one night, because when the house was sitting, you'd go home and they'd give you a call and let you know when the house was getting up. And anyway, this night, because at this stage I was living here, and I got a phone call at 11 minutes to 11, the house was getting up at 11 o'clock. So away I went. I was doing 80 and 90, and I went through two red traffic lights to try and get in there in time. So got in, turned around North Terrace, pulled up at Parliament House, and a couple of the lads said, "Oh, you're going to be in trouble." I said, "Why?" I said, "See the white car going under Morford Street Bridge?" I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, that's Jack Rice's car, and a white Rice. And that's where Jeff is." So next morning, he said, "What happened last night, Reg?" And I better not say exactly what I said to him, but I said, "All right, Jeff, you effing well tell me what happened last night." I said, "I was called at 11 minutes to 11. I got here just after 11, and you were going under the Morford Street Bridge in Jeff White's car." I said, "You tell me what effing well happened." Of course, I used the full words, not just F. "Oh, well," he said, "we'd better get you called early." I said, "That's not the point." I said, you would have known I'd be in there, and you couldn't just wait a couple of minutes. I've even seen the Premier waiting out front for his driver." So when I got back to garage, I told Ernie, I said, "You can get another driver for Jeff. If he was going to, you know, any other time, we'd be out the front half an hour, 40 minutes waiting for them." Mm. While they're back inside, bloody boozing on. And I said, he couldn't even wait 2 minutes. So I said, "You can get another driver for him." And from then on, I never drove Jeff anymore. I drove a few of the Liberal MPs and a couple of the other Labor MPs, but I wouldn't drive Jeff again.
So how much longer did you do that job of driving?
I think I was there for about 6 years, all told.
So and to the 80s?
Then I was a retirement age, so I retired. And then I just sort of relaxed for the next, up until now. I'm 93.
So you've been retired for 41 years.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Has that, the 41 years, has that passed quickly?
Now you've brought it up, it does, when you think about it, it does seem to have, you know, gone quick. When you look back, you think, hell, that was 40 odd years ago. It couldn't have been, but yeah, it was. The wife and I went back to Singapore for a bit of a holiday, and we went back to, we went to England first and then across to Ireland, because the wife was Irish, and stayed with her family for a little while.
And whereabouts in Ireland were they from?
Kilkenny.
The city of Kilkenny?
Yeah. And we went for a bit of a walk 2 days after we got there, and she showed us this two-story brick house. That's where they used to live. And two days after, we went for another walk, and it was all just rubble. They knocked it down.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Then when one of her cousins who lived in Canada, he said, "I said, pity you're not coming our way." So we had a book of flight to Canada, so we headed off to Canada.
Terrific.
Spent a few days there with them and had a good look around and went down to Niagara Waterfalls and whatnot. Yeah.
So you enjoy the travelling?
Oh, I did, yeah. I'd be like that young couple. I'd like to sell this place, buy a decent caravan for the rest of the time I've got and shoot through. But
if you or someone you know would like to be captured in a podcast, contact Christian Teusner via this email address, theemutree@gmail.com. theemutree@gmail.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening.